I'm Richard Hall, and you're listening to the Mojo Record Club.
Welcome back to the Mojo Record Club. It is, if I need to remind you, a place where music lovers, musicians, crate diggers, writers, readers, and special guests like Richard Hawley get to share their love for classic albums, weird lost gems, and brand new revelations. As you probably know if you've listened to part one, Richard Hawley turned out to have a lot of revelations for us, and so we split it into two episodes. This is part two. If you haven't managed to listen to part one with Richard, please go back and listen to it because it's exceptionally good value. In the meantime, let's kick off part two. Richard's going to start talking about the Byrds and Gene Clark in that context. So we're going to throw you in the deep end a bit, but hopefully it'll make sense once you've listened to the first one. Please enjoy.
You're listening to the Mojo Record. Did
your dad like the Byrds?
Yeah, he liked them, you know. He was deeply wary of anything that went away from the... You know, any apples that rolled away from the tree, I remember, my history teacher, he said to me once, he said at school, he said, Hawley, can you stay back after the lesson, please? And I was like, shit, what have I done? Like, I haven't done anything. Oh, that's probably the thing. I haven't done anything. That's why I'm in trouble. I've been thinking about guitars and music. And he just said, very perfunctory, he said, me and the wife are getting divorced. We have a rather large record collection. We can't decide who owns what. We've decided you're having it. Because I used to write the names of artists that I like, and it certainly wasn't the artist in the pop charts. He was Blind Boy Fuller and whatever the hell else.
Right.
Elvis and Billy Lee Riley and all this stuff. And,
yeah.
And this is a reason why I'm telling you this. amongst these records, there was Love Forever Changes, The Crazy World of Arthur Brown, that was in there. And he just turned up with this big box of records at school. And I had to do three trips taking them home on bus.
Yeah,
because there's so many.
Yeah.
And there was some stuff I didn't like in there, but there was Hendrix's first two albums. And I brought those home and put them on, and listening to the intro to Foxy Lady completely changed my world. Just that intro, I thought, you know, alone. And Dad was home. He was working in the factories. And he said, oh, is that Jimi Hendrix? And he heard literally like a couple of bars on the intro of Hendrix playing. And he goes, because I work with him. That's another story for another time.
No, it isn't.
Oh, it is. Yeah. I've got so many stories. Dad used to work in the 60s. He, my Uncle Frankie, he played with Dave Berry and the Cruisers.
Okay.
And anyway, the point, going back to that, Dad had got a very open mind.
Yeah.
And he encouraged open-mindedness. And he'd let me... and my sisters play anything in the house, you know. And I remember bringing Nevermind the Bollocks on by the Pistols. And he looked at the cover and just goes, when your grandma's in, maybe put that, don't have it, that one hanging around. And that was all he said, you know. And he listened to it and he thought it was pretty good. He let us play anything, you know.
Yeah. I think. You've already talked about how Gene Clark's, I guess we could call it, reticence about fame or suspicion about fame, obviously was a kind of...
a wise man.
Yeah, a mitigating factor in perhaps why this record wasn't a big deal. But given that I suppose around the time it came out was kind of year zero for country rock in many respects... do you think that this record's kind of closer affiliation to bluegrass kind of countered against its more mainstream success in a way, because
its
it was a bit of a harder sell than Sweetheart of the Rodeo or the Burritos records?
Yeah, it's probably more, like you say, more authentic, you know. And the fact that Gene Clark wouldn't do... it just never helps if you do no promotion on a record. Is Kel Surprise why it does nothing. You know what I mean? It's very rare that that happens. But I would pull you up on the country rock thing. You need to listen to George Jones's early stuff. When the birth of country rock to me, I don't think it was an accident. And it was basically when all the old country stars or young country stars of the day got caught out by rockabilly.
Right. Yeah.
And they went, oh, there's this phenomenon called rockabilly that later became rock and roll. And you listen to Webb Pierce, Teenage Boogie, which Mark Bolan plundered wholesale, that album, and took it somewhere else. And George Jones' stuff on Star Day when he did White Lightning that The Fall covered later.
Yeah, of course.
Is a lot of that early country rock stuff, I think, happened by accident. It was because they were trying to catch up with the phenomenon of rockabilly, that all of a sudden they added these heavy or heavier guitars, you know.
Yeah, I suppose, but it's cultural signifiers as well, though, isn't it? It's the long hair and the album era is what I mean by country rock, I suppose, as much as, I mean, from those early Sun recordings, you can see that there's a definite affinity between country and rock and roll. But I think it's that kind of, that touch point where more the album era, I would think, you know, like that's... And
yeah, you're right. But the curious thing about a lot of the country rock stuff is that always struck me, and I don't know whether you thought about it before, John, but it's the curious thing that you're living in an era, the 60s, where it was progressive and dispensing with anything that had gone before, you know, ideas and traditions and... the formal nature of middle class American life, that actually a lot of musicians chose to adopt as their framework or whatever that they progressed further with was something that was so traditional.
Yeah,
that went back to even pre-recorded history, you know, with songs that were just handed down in oral tradition. Is that I've always found that as the schism of that is actually not something that needs overanalyzing, but something that's quite beautiful, really.
Well, I always think that folk music and traditional musics have a much greater affinity with experimental music than people sometimes give them credit for.
Absolutely.
The open-endedness of ancient music, you know, not just the drones of English folk music, but just the inherent flexibility of a song that's lasted decades or centuries, and what can be done with it, and also what has been allowed to be done with it. I think in spite of our perspectives on people like Pete Seeger from a distance and that kind of thing, I don't think a lot of the people involved in folk music were quite as doctrinaire as they seem from a distance, that they were pretty open-minded about songs are free to be interpreted. You know, actually, the last guest on this podcast before you, we had Richard Thompson on, and we were talking about exactly the same kind of thing, because obviously he was at the kind of the pinch point of it at the same time in the UK.
He was there.
Yeah. And he was talking about Doc Watson. The record he brought in was Doc Watson and Family. And, you know, but yeah, I think, I mean, how do you feel about this record? I mean, are you a fan of the Burritos and things like that as well?
Yeah, some stuff. It's odd with him. If I was going to choose between the two, I'd always go with Gene Clark. He always seemed more authentic to me.
Do you think because of his background to some degree? Are you wary of Parsons' background?
No, not at all. It's the music. I like some of it, but some of it, I don't know. It's a personal thing. You know, you can't be forced to connect something with something just because you think you should. But there's something about it that has left me feeling a bit remote, really, or not. But and maybe it's because I connected with this particular album so young.
Right, yeah.
That's another factor that again, you know, analysis has the word anal in it. So it's just, you know, I don't want to be anal about it. And I just find this record incredibly beautiful. You know, songs like Something's Wrong and With Care From Someone, that's so awesome. She Darked the Sun. And actually, there was the album after this that nearly made it as great, that Through the Morning, Through the Night.
Yeah.
And it's so patchy, that record, which is a shame. But there are some tracks, obviously, I think their interest had waned by that point, perhaps.
Yeah, well, maybe they had other fish to fry. And I mean,
well, subsequently, it's been proved to be so.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if at any point there was any discussion that this record was going to be called, was going to be credited to Dillard, Clark, and Leaden. Because, I mean, Bernie Leaden co-wrote six of the songs. I mean, the vast majority of the record he had an equal hand in, you know, and it's his is the third harmony. And the singing as well, you know, it's kind of as much a trio record as it's a duo record.
Really. Absolutely, yeah. It's got drums on it as well, which are only, you know, quite light. I think the drummer, didn't he play in the, what he was, noted garage bands? I think it was the Left Bank or...
Oh, really? I don't know. I must say, I don't know.
I did find that out once. I should have made a note of that.
I know Hillman and Sneaky Pete were on the second one, weren't they? But
Chris Hillman plays mandolin on this.
On this one, yeah.
Yeah, and trying to look it up. Andy Belling's on it. He was amazing.
For the current issue of Mojo, I put together a CD of kind of form of a Birds Companion CD, actually. And one of the things that I put on it.
I can't wait to hear that.
Yeah, no, one of the things that I'd never actually listened to before was Hillman's pre-Birds band, the Scottsville Squirrel Barkers. Have you ever heard them?
No.
I mean, but they are absolute raw bluegrass. Mm. It's really good. And you know that kind of... you know that point where bluegrass sounds a little bit deranged, that it gets that kind of hysterical edge.
Have you ever heard, I'm going to have to send you this if you haven't heard it, John, it's called Little Birdie by the Stanley Brothers.
Don't recall immediately, no.
It's from a live album they did. It's a pretty obscure record, but my records are all next door. I could find it pretty quickly, but...
Yeah.
They recorded that weirdly enough on King Records, which was noted for having James Brown and Little Richard Brown, you know. But they also put I've got to somehow send you this. I know exactly what you mean. It's Little Birdie by the Stanley Brothers, but there's one specific version when they're playing live.
Right.
And they're playing like shredding heavy metal.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
It's insane. And the speed that it's played at as well is just. Yeah. And they just do it so effortlessly, you know. Yeah. But I know exactly what you mean. It's literally, you know, just literally deranged, insane.
Exactly. Yeah. And at the same time, it sounds absolutely unhinged, but incredibly virtuosic. Like they never flub a note.
No, it's just unheard of. Yeah. They just do it so easily, you know.
Yeah.
The only thing that's slightly worrying me is, did we cover the fact that in this record there is a deep melancholy?
We didn't really, did we?
No, it's something that's bugging me, that, to be fair. I think it's important.
We talked about bluegrass a lot more than we did about the sort of the emotional core of the record, really, didn't we?
So, yeah. I think it's Gene Clark as a human being I think it ultimately led to his own destruction in a lot of ways, his self-destruction, is that feeling when you listen to his music that it's a deep melancholy, you know. It's not a depression, because that's an entirely different thing, but this deep current within him as a writer and as a person, I don't think he wasn't faking it, you know, and to be that eloquent, you certainly can't. But I think the root core of the record, like I touched on before, the fact that he'd just left the Birds, Doug Dillard had left the Dillards, and they'd got, in that period of time, which was an intensely creative period of music, you know, that it seemed to be this record is just almost like a safe haven almost. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah,
a point in time where there was, you know, they'd signed a big record deal with A&M Records, but and there was obviously a lot of expectation on him as the lead singer of a band that had had these huge hits that were, you know, on the level with the Beatles, you know, and the fan mania around the Birds was equivalent, you know. But it just seemed to be that it's almost like an eddy in a river, you know. Like a point where the current of the river just doesn't seem to be as insane, where they just found time to engage with things that they really loved. And obviously musically, but lyrically as well, is that it may be, I don't know whether I'm hanging too much on this coat hook of an idea, but it just seemed for him to just break out of that mold and allow him as a person to come out more, which are probably, you know, under the umbrella of the Birds, there was, I mean, obviously anybody who's a fan of theirs who's read anything about them knows that there was a heavy competition for songwriting, and and they'd often get rid of brilliant songs because of the infighting in the band, you know. But the core of the record to me is there's no kind of teenage screaming stuff going. They're very adult themes, you know, and he was still pretty young at this point of time, and it's a long time before he did No Other, which is a classic, or White Light and all those records, which are incredible records. But it's almost like you can witness in recording terms, you know, the birth of that tree, you know.
Well, it's also, I think it's a really good point to make, because I think sometimes you can see Gene Clark as a quote-unquote tortured artist that reached its apotheosis in No Other, but that this record was this kind of kicking back kind of detour, that it was this kind of rootsy kind of, you know, it can be the two things simultaneously. It's a good time, relaxed, easygoing escape from the pressures of being a pop superstar, but at the same time, there's a through line of melancholy, like, you know, which, you know, it's not as if the kind of the emotional heft of No Other appeared out of nowhere.
Yeah, it's not in a vacuum at all. No. You know. But also, actually, funnily enough, speaking about that, in a way, the themes of the record are quite traditional as well, because bluegrass and country music often deals with death and extreme loneliness and things that are not heard in the charts. Not very often, you know.
No, I mean, it does. I was just wondering about this. I wonder how many I was trying to think of another artist of comparable sort of pop fame as Gene Clark was in 68, who'd so consciously turned their back on the obvious superstar kind of path as he does with this, and with the Gosling Brothers record as well.
Right? In a different way, probably the only equivalent would be somebody like Syd Barrett, you know.
Yeah, but
obviously that was a complete.
Yeah,
I mean, I love his two solo records. I think they're beautiful records. But I mean, his was more of a complete implosion. He did nothing after.
Yeah,
but in terms of just turning your back on it all, you know, maybe, you know, Peter Green, perhaps.
Maybe, but that's slightly later, isn't it? I mean, it's like the courage to do this, and you know, I don't think Peter Green was a teen idol in quite the same way as Gene Clark was, you know, the guy with the tambourine, you know?
Yeah, he's, you know, you're right. I think he's I mean, I came up with those two wonderful artists just without thinking about it too much, I guess.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there are really good examples that I've completely forgotten that I'll be, you know, ridiculed by.
And when you put Kettle on, you'll be going, oh, bugger,
Yeah, exactly.
I should have said her. Yeah,
exactly. If you had to choose one track from the album that we can play out on, which one would it be?
Fucking hell. Can't we just play the whole record?
I don't think our rights agreements would actually allow us to do that, sadly.
Let's play Out on the Side, the first track.
Perfect.
It's either that or She Dark the Sun, but let's go with Out on the Side, because if anyone is listening to this, that is a Birds fan but hasn't encountered Dillard and Clark, this is the connecting track, I think, between the two things, you know.
Perfect. Okay, let's play this then. This is Out on the Side, written. It's the only track written by Gene Clark on his own, I think, actually, isn't it?
Well, there you go.
Released on The Fantastic Expedition of Dillard and Clark on A&M Records from October 1968. Just to know you are going to stay. Out on the side, out on the side.
Thanks a lot, folks, for listening to the Mojo Record Club.
All right, this really is the end of the Mojo Record Club for this week, I promise. Thank you so much to Richard Hawley for being such excellent company for the past hour or so over two episodes. It's our first two-parter, so and well-deserving, I think. We'll have yet another episode up in a few days, hopefully, when Andrew's better and he and I get to talk about our favourite records of the month. In the meantime, please have a look in the episode description for full details. Episodes description, sorry. I forgot we'd done two here again. Please have a look in the episodes description for full details of all the tracks we've played. And sorry again to be one of those podcast guys. Don't forget to like and subscribe and tell all your friends to give us a listen. It really does help. Like Andrew often says, you can all join in.
Have a good one, guys.
Thank you. Good luck with Banger and the tour, anyway.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Take care.
Cheers,
Richard.
See you later. Thank you.
Lots of love. Bye. You've been listening to the Mojo Record Club with me, Richard Hawley.